The name's Wire. Barb Wire.
Ugh. Wonder how she got that job.
If you're gonna tell me your life story, why don't you sit down?
We are your hosts, Steve Benson and Paul Schultz, and this is Rough Draft.
Not bad.
That's not bad. And what is Rough Draft, you may be asking yourself? We're asking ourselves the same question, as a matter of fact. This is a new podcast. Obviously, you found us because of the Don't Panic radio show. This one's going to have some truth in it. As opposed to the other one, or at least the truth as we see it.
That's right.
And kind of our philosophy is truth is how you look at it. And we're creating new truths every day.
That's right.
But this one's about writing. The name probably helped you see that. And Rough Draft being that first pencil to a piece of paper, or a pen to a piece of paper, and taking something that's kind of in your head and putting it down in the real world.
Right. It's also a metaphor for life in general. That's why, one of the reasons why I like it so much.
Life is a rough draft. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. We won't get to look at the whole thing finished until the end.
Well, I was going to say that, yeah, life is like a rough draft without a chance to do revisions.
That's right.
There's no second draft, third draft, final draft. It just is.
Right. So write drunk and edit sober.
That's the philosophy, right? I guess the message is, and this show really, one of my fascinations with the new media that's out there and that we're experimenting with is, this show, I think, will be what we'll do, you know, just to be kind of specific about it. We're going to talk about writing, creating something from nothing. And then we're going to, once in a while, we'll have some guests on to tell us about their creative process and maybe read from their work.
Right.
And Paul and I will read from our work. And we'll just kind of put it out there. Now, it's a little bit, for me, I'm hoping the evolution is things that may not work on paper will work in the audio realm.
Right.
So it'll be more than just reading something that's meant to be read.
Right.
it'll be sort of like performance art in a way. Well, it'll be exactly like performance art because it's going to be more than us just reading.
Right, right.
We're going to use the Audacity tool to add some other audio elements.
Right. Well, I got hooked on a lot of stuff like that, and around the time of doing the second Halloween show for Don't Panic, because I was listening to a lot of, you know, scary podcasts, I guess you call them, and some of them were just they weren't like people talking and then doing stuff. They were like chapter stories that were intended to be spooky, and they were very much like the old radio shows that, you know, from the 30s and 40s. And I think that's the way to go. I mean, I was hooked from there. I'm like, yeah, let's do something like that.
Sort of what is old becomes new again.
Yeah, yeah. And anybody can do it. Back then, you know, there were production studios and production costs and all that, but with the internet and pretty much everything being free or nearly free, anybody who wants to do it can actually do it and get it out there.
And it's interesting, the word curate has become common now. And I think what that is everybody was excited that anybody can publish anything now. There's no barrier to, you know, there's no a book publisher or radio station director standing in the way of you and your audience,
right?
And the which is, you know, potentially 5 billion people, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the result is now there are 5 billion people putting stuff out there, whether or not it's interesting.
Right.
So curation has become a buzzword because it's saying, okay, there are a million podcasts. Which ones should I be listening to so I don't waste my time?
Mm-hmm.
Let us help you with that. Listen to this one.
Yeah, that's a good start.
The Don't Panic radio show. And then listen to Do It Indie Radio Hour and Chop Liver, and then you just about got it covered. No,
seriously. You're not going to have much time to do anything else.
Yeah. So my a little bit of history on my writing and why I write, then I want to hear your history as well.
Okay.
Even though I probably know it already. this show is not for you and I. For you and me.
Right.
This show is for our listeners.
That's right.
So, I don't know when I first started writing, but I know I got an assignment in creative writing class, and I was fascinated with creative writing class because I thought, I had been taking a lot of science and math and stuff, and learning how stuff works was fascinating to me because I had this fascination when I was younger with, okay, I can see and feel and taste and touch the physical world, but why is the sky blue? And why does the earth rotate on its axis and go around the sun? And what are leaves made out of? And why are they green? And like, I was learning all this stuff and I was just going, there are answers to all these questions. This is great.
Mm-hmm.
And down to a molecular level, I was learning how a tree survives and for hundreds of years and why it sheds its leaves and how photosynthesis works. And this was great. And then I walk into this creative writing class and it's like something interesting that has never been written before is going to end up on that piece of paper.
Yeah.
And I just thought, well, how does that work? I can't imagine where that comes from. Let's talk about the molecules or something.
I can describe what this paper is made out of.
Yeah, right. And I know how the ink gets from inside the pen onto the paper. And just the whole process, and I didn't really come out of there with a deep understanding of the creative process.
Mm-hmm.
What I did come out of there with, though, was a short story that I had written that had never been written before. Mm-hmm. And the teacher said it was pretty good.
You got like an A on it, if I remember right. So
well, I think I got an A, man. And you know what? There's nothing higher than an A. They don't make like a, this is better than an A.
It's like a color.
A color. Yeah, what would be better than an A? I mean, it's like double A? No, double A is smaller.
Yeah, double A would be smaller, yeah.
Yeah. Not that I would know.
But you can always find out. That's...
Yeah, that's right. But then a few years back, I would say, how long has it been? 5 or 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
I took the creative writing course, and I reacquainted with my friend Dave, and the internet came out, so you and I started communicating more. We used to write letters to each other. Correct that. Paul used to write letters to me.
And you would reply to every 10th one. So
yeah. I found some of your letters the other day. Hey, maybe we could read those on the show.
Oh, that would be great. There's a time capsule. I have the 3 that you wrote me, so there's that.
Oh, the 3. You know what the internet's done for me in terms of communicating? I always thought to write a letter, I had to have something to say.
Mm-hmm.
And I went back and read some of yours, and I mean this in the nicest way possible. You didn't always have something to say.
No.
But you were communicating.
Right.
And the purpose of the letter wasn't like, here's some information I need to give you.
Mm-hmm.
It was, let's just be in touch, right?
Yeah.
What the internet's done for me is I realize I don't need to have something to say, and I can just like type some silly thought I just had, and that's kept us in touch for the last, well, since we both got on Facebook.
Yeah, been about six. God, I think it's been almost 6 years for me.
Yeah,
on Facebook.
Yeah,
I went into it kicking and screaming. So I still liked my MySpace, but you know, there goes that.
Now it's Snapchat and Instagram.
I don't even know what that means.
Yeah, me neither. The creative writing class and, mm-hmm. and my friend Dave and you, that's where I really started to kind of understand the creative process.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no molecular level thing to understand about it. I imagine someday scientists will figure out how the brain does it and how it works and everything, and then they'll design a computer to do it, and we won't need authors anymore. But for now, and for the next couple of centuries at least,
hopefully,
yeah, there's a process that works. We don't understand why it works, but it works.
Right.
And I think that's what this show is about. It's going to be exploring that process. Different people have different processes.
Mm-hmm.
I find that there are some elements that are common, though. Don't you?
Yeah.
What's the history of your relationship with writing? This is, let's pause for a second. You're listening to WRDDP, broadcasting from our studios in Central Indiana. My name is Chesterton Station. I'm talking with my... I'm talking with my good friend Alistair Tree Knob, and we're talking about the creative process. Tree Knob,
why gotta be? Wasn't he one of the Ents in the Tree Knob?
Why I gotta be Tree Knob? Why can't I be Station? Why can't I be Power Station?
That's right.
Alistair Power. That's what you'll be. Alistair Powers. And I'll be Chesterfield Station.
Chesterfield Station.
You can just call me Chester. Anyway, go on.
Anyway.
What is your... Alistair, what is the history of your relationship with the creative process, if I may ask?
It's funny you'd say early on in the show about... Yeah. You know, there's no lies. This is all, it's all truths.
Play the tape back.
Years and years ago, I used to belong to a writer's club, and this new member showed up, and afterwards we all went, this is how it works. We go to the writer's club, watch the clock, and then when our time ended, we ran next door and got drunk because there was a bar right across from the library. And that became the more informal, more honest, because it was the core group would go. But anyway, this one lady showed up, and it was her first time, and she was interested, so she came with us, and she asked me, she goes, "How long have you been a writer?" And I said, "I've been telling lies as long as I've been able to speak, so my whole life." So I think a good portion of writing is telling lies.
Who can tell the most believable lie?
That's right. It's not a lie if you believe it.
Right.
No, anyway, I started writing, you know, short stories clear back in junior high, just here and there. Like, I'd read a book and then do, like, a rip-off short story version of it.
Oh, nice.
I was trying to figure out, you know, where, you know, I, you know, Hitchhiker's Guide was a huge influence on me.
Mm-hmm.
And as a lot of people know, your short story was a huge influence on me because then spent the next decade trying to write sequels to that short story.
You spent a decade trying to rewrite that story, and that's either really flattering because it was very influential, or it's really depressing because it was so bad. It took a decade to get it right.
Right. Yeah, and I still haven't gotten it right. After a while, though, I then started to write my own, you know, different types of stories, and then I got involved both writing and drawing comics, which is a whole different type of writing, and now I'm back to doing more prose. I guess prose is the word you'd use. So that's basically my past 30 years in a nutshell.
And when you sit down to write, walk me through your... From nothing to something, what's the process? Or do you even think about it as a process?
For me, see, I know people who will have, they'll have an idea and they'll polish it in their head to where they'll have it start to finish, you know, thought out, before they even start working. I don't work that way. A lot of times with me, I'll just get like an impulse. on an idea, like a stray line for something will hit me, or like I'll be influenced by something that I see or, you know, around me, and I'll just start writing out like free, just whatever follows that thought, mm-hmm. you know, and I'll write two or three pages of it without even knowing where the hell it's going. And then as I write it, if it's good, it'll evolve into something.
Mm-hmm.
I seldom, if ever, have an idea as a whole. It just becomes like an impulse, yeah. like I said. And then I'll write down two or three pages of it, and eventually, if it sticks, you know, like good thick gravy, if it sticks, I'll continue with it till it's done.
Good thick gravy.
That's right. Good thick gravy. This portion of Rough Draft brought to you by Good Thick Gravy.
This program is supported by the local station, donors like you, and Good Thick Gravy.
Brought to you by a grant from the Thick Gravy Corporation.
Something I've noticed about myself that others may have noticed as well is there are two things that, well, one thing that influences me to write.
Mm-hmm.
It's not having an idea necessarily, although sometimes that does happen. Once in a while, I'll say once a year, maybe twice a year, I'll have an idea and I'll just have to whip out my tiny computer that I carry in my pocket, which is also my phone, and just start typing in my idea. That's how the story I'm going to read today, Dave Doesn't Kill Himself at the End, I'm going to read the first chapter. That's how that came about. I was on a shuttle bus at work, and the idea hit me, and I just started typing with my thumbs. And then I got to my desk, and I was supposed to be working, and I just kept writing instead. But
that sounds familiar.
Yeah.
I've done that a lot. I remember when you sent me that, and I read it, and I'm like, holy crap, this is really good. You're like, yeah, I wrote it with my thumbs on the shuttle bus. I'm like, fuck you.
it's weird how that works, because you hear these stories like, I don't know, Sylvester Stallone wrote Rocky in one night. You know, he just had the idea and he sat down and he wrote it.
Yeah.
I don't believe that for a second.
Yeah.
I think when Dave Doesn't Kill Himself at the End becomes a feature-length movie 20 years from now, I think mm-hmm. people will ask me how it came about, and I'm going to tell them I wrote it with my thumbs on a shuttle bus, and I'm not going to tell them that it took another 25 years to refine it and finish it.
Or that it took your life up to that point to start it.
Oh, that's a great point.
Mickey Spillane claimed that he locked himself in a hotel room for a week and wrote Eye of the Jury, but I think I also called bullshit on that because there was stuff that led up to that point.
Right.
H. Rider Haggard read Around the World in 80 Days, hated it. He bet his brother-in-law he could write a better story in like a month, and he went out and he wrote King Solomon's Mind, which, by the way, yes, is better. But I don't believe for a second he only wrote that in a month. It's, you know, as a writer, I call BS on that, because we know it doesn't, you know, so everything builds up to that point.
It's not that much different from, say, a concert pianist who gets up there with no music,
mm-hmm.
No sheet music, and just sits down and just hammers out a 45-minute concerto, and everybody's amazed. And they're like, oh, my God, that guy, he's a genius. And, you know, there's this applause, and that was 45 minutes. Oh, my gosh, and he just sat down and did mm-hmm. it. And you go, well, hold on. When he was two, his parents sat him down in front of a piano.
Yeah.
And he probably has played that 45-minute concerto at least 200 or 300 times.
Yeah.
If not more. For 6 hours every day, he's doing nothing but sitting there playing the piano.
Yeah.
I think it's the same with a writer. And yeah, if you go bang out Solomon's Mind in 30 days, well, you know, you've been practicing writing Solomon's Mind for 30 years.
I know a lot of guitar players who they'll be sitting around picking, and they'll be like, this is what I do when it comes time for a solo and I don't know what else to do. And they'll like blend a couple, they got a couple things rehearsed and they just kind of blend it together. So they've been practicing that impromptu spur of the moment solo as long as they've been playing guitar. So I think it all leads up to the point where you start.
And that's what I tell people if they're like, well, I want to be a writer someday. And I'm like, oh, well, that's easy. You can be a writer right now. They're like, well, what do I have to do? It's like, write? Anyone who writes is a writer. And then I'm called an asshole. And I'm like, I'm not really being an asshole here. Everybody's creating in their mind all the time. I think that's the thing that I've gotten out of all this thought and research is every single person on the planet, if you're breathing, you're creating. What makes a writer is they sit down and they start putting stuff down on paper. And people go, well, I don't know what to write. It's like, doesn't matter. As long as you put your fingers on a keyboard or pen to paper and just start writing things, eventually the shit you've been creating every day your entire life is going to start ending up on the written page.
Yeah, and you have to get the thought in your head that you can't do it out of your head. Because as soon as you can like free your mind from that whole thing, it's gone. The part of your brain that says you can't do it is gone. And I think that's one of the keys that you have to use to actually hammer something out. And so many people, I could never do that. I could never do that. Yeah, you can if you just stop telling yourself you can't do it. Right. Whether you become like the dude that wrote like Da Vinci Code or Stephen King or Jackie Collins or whoever the hell else, unless that's not important.
Right.
You have to. Don't even think about that either. Don't even think about, well, someday it's going to be a novel or whatever. You basically got to just pull a lot of that speculation and a lot of that can't do it and what's it going to be thing out of your head. You know, and once that, you're free to do whatever the hell you want.
Yeah, so which says don't make the process the end in of itself.
Yes.
So don't sit down to write a novel.
Right.
You know, don't be the guy that wrote King Solomon's Mind and say, I'm going to write something in 30 days. How's my daughter? Hang on.
Sure.
Hello?
Hey.
What's up?
What do you call for?
I didn't call. You called.
I'll let my dial do that.
Oh, cool. That's the best butt dial I got all day.
Okay. Are you doing your show?
Yeah, we're doing a show.
Okay, bye.
Bye. My first butt dial for my daughter.
That's awesome.
It's funny.
It's really good when they do that and they don't realize it, and you can listen to them while they talk. <It's> like, just saying.
They say things like, my dad is so cool.
Mm.
My dad's doing a radio show.
That's exactly what they talk about. They talk about how cool their parents are.
Don't set out to write a novel, just set out to write.
Right.
So that leads me to the other, so the spur of the moment inspiration that happens once every 5 years causes me to write. The other thing that causes me to write is a deadline or something that says, well, there are two ways to do it, two ways to get me to write. One is to get me to promise to write every day, and somehow I trick myself into writing every day, and then you know, good writing comes out of that eventually. And that's actually the number one bit of advice that people give who are professional writers. They say they won't ever tell you what to do, but they'll say, I know me and I know I have to write every day for 30 minutes or 2 hours or whatever it is.
Yeah.
The other way to get me to write is to have a specific purpose in mind. So Dave, which I just got done telling people not to do, but Dave doesn't kill himself at the end was the impetus, like the inspiration was the impetus for the first rough draft. The thing that kept me working on it was that creative writing class, because everybody was to have, was to be working on something and to bring it to class and be workshopped and all that.
Yes.
So that kept me doing it. So then I decided this morning that I would read chapter one, because then I'd have to write chapter two.
Yes.
For the next, for another future show. So that, that'll get me to write.
Right. Our good friend, Bill Wilkerson, one time we were joking and he's like, never don't give an artist a deadline.
Yes.
Give us a deadline and the day before it's due is when we're going to do it. And the same holds true for writing, especially in this case, you know, you're writing for a deadline. So now you have it, but you work well with a deadline because that's how you, that's you, you know, you have a point that you have to reach, so you're going to reach that point. Some people don't operate that way. The one thing I've noticed is, and you kind of touched on it with the class that you were taking, writing is like being in a bubble. You know, you can write in a bubble. It's best to write in a bubble where nothing can touch you, not even you. But it's also really good to have a group of people like-minded like yourself, writers, to work with on a writer's club, take your stuff there, get in the company of writers, it just keeps you going, you know. But always then step out and do your own thing. Absolutely. But then go back to it. And it's a huge boost and a huge push for you to get better. You know, you can, like when I draw, I write, but specifically when I draw, I try to compete with myself. I just did this. I really like it. The next thing has to be better. The same thing holds true with writing.
Yeah.
And one way to see whether you've gotten better is to be with people who are also writers and hear what they have to say about it.
And there you have it, folks. I think you just described for me the purpose of the show. Rough Draft is my writer's group.
I'm hoping it's a writer's group for as many people as we can possibly get.
Absolutely. Anybody who's writing is welcome to come on the show.
Right. Not everybody's library, for instance, hosts writers' clubs. Not every writer belongs to a writers' club. A lot of people write, you know, under the covers and are scared to death to have people read their stuff. But, you know, we're here for that person, you know, writing under the covers.
Yeah. It's just us.
Yeah.
It's your friendly neighborhood radio show host.
That's right.
We'll be honest with you. I mean, that's the other thing you need is a group of people who will be honest with you and not just go, oh, that's really good.
Yeah. Like, yeah,
you know,
don't.
The difference between.
Don't give it to your
the
mom.
Difference between the sugarcoaters, the difference between the sugarcoaters and us will be we actually know that you're capable of writing an excellent piece of work.
Mm-hmm.
Right. People who go, oh, that's really good, honey, don't believe you can actually do it.
Right.
So they're like, I don't want to hurt his feelings
right.
for no purpose whatsoever, because no matter how much I tell him this part sucked, this part's okay, no matter how much I tell him that, they're never going to get it anyway.
Right.
So why not just make them feel good? We don't give a shit about your feelings.
That's right.
And
obviously.
We don't claim to be right either. I mean, we may tell you something sucks, and it may be the best thing in the world. We're not pros, you know, at that.
The other thing, the other most important thing that you can do as a writer, other than write, is develop thick skin.
Oh yeah.
Because someone who reads your stuff and will be honest with you, might not be what you want to hear, but you're gonna get butt hurt pretty quick if you don't develop thick skin.
Yeah. So, with that, shall we bring in our first couple of works?
Yeah.
to be critiqued by our audience.
Yeah, and by all means, please critique what you hear on the show. That would be awesome. Good or bad.
Especially if you like it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. Especially if you like it, but if you don't like it, we want to hear that too.
And we're talking to you, SF James.
That's right.
You know who you are.
And you know what you did.
And you love us enough to be honest with us.
That's right.
So which one are you going to do first?
Well, you know, what you mentioned this earlier about, like, not really knowing what it is and that kind of thing, and how we were talking earlier about, you know, the radio shows and stuff. And don't focus on it being a novel. Just write it. Right. Well, I think I've reached the point with this story that I'm working on, because I've been working on it for so long, that I would be happy if it was just like a radio drama until, you know, who knows? It may never end as far. I mean,
yeah.
I consider it it's a soap opera with violence is what I'm going to call this thing.
Nice.
At the moment, it doesn't have a title. Right now, I'm just calling it In the Rough, but I don't have a title for it just yet. Chapter 1, Cooper. Scotch? Please. Ice? Neat. Ah, a man who knows how to drink scotch. Cooper Brennan watched as the man in the Armani shirt and tie poured two fingers of golden brown scotch into a squatty glass and handed it to him. He accepted it with a slight nod. The man in the nice shirt poured himself a glass and sat down behind his desk. My name's Brett Hollister. Cooper. I know all about you. Cooper sipped his scotch. I wasn't aware my family had a lawyer. How much are you bilking her for over this whole thing? Hollister sipped his scotch. I appreciate your hostility, Brennan, but it's misplaced. 5 years will do that to a guy. Nobody put that gun in your hand. Says you. If you ask me, the judge was pretty lean on you boys. Your family's money probably had something to do with that, but that's not my business. We just did what needed to be done. It was a long time ago. We all did our time for what we did. And we'd probably do it all over again if we weren't so much... older? I was going for smarter. Are you sure about that? Look, Hollister, I appreciate a good belt of scotch at 10 a.m. as much as the next guy. But what's this all about? You're a hard guy to find, Cooper. Ever hear of a smartphone? I'm not stupid. Why would I need a smartphone? Hollister chuckled in spite of himself, reached into the drawer, pulled out a small manila envelope, and tossed it on the desk. It slid to a stop near Cooper. Leaning forward, Cooper picked it up. It felt empty, except for a key. What's this? A key? Well, no shit. It belonged to your father. It's yours now. Does my mother know about this? She does. There's also a significant amount of money set up in a trust fund for you. That's already been taken care of, but he specifically requested the key be delivered to you. Cooper looked over the little envelope a moment, then tucked it into his jacket. Didn't think he cared. Apparently he did. You missed the funeral. It was nice as far as funerals go. Small. Yeah, well, Dad didn't have many friends. Cooper downed the last of his scotch, stood up, and set the glass down heavily upon the desk. What about you, son? What about me? Do you have many friends? A few. I can't imagine why. A few's all I need. All I ever needed. Your mother was right about you. Well, I am her son. She said you were a hard guy to like. She said you were a walking contradiction. But from where I stand, you're a hard-bitten guy who knows good scotch, Chinese philosophy, and is angry at the world. Not the world. Just the people in it. Why do you hate yourself so much, Brennan? You charge by the hour, Hollister? Even I don't have that kind of money. Good morning, Brennan. Cooper turned towards the door. What about your mother? Cooper put his hand on the knob. What about her? You planning on seeing her while you're in town? Do you visit your mother when you go home, Hollister? I'm 65 years old, Brennan. My mother's dead. Cooper left Hollister's office and stepped out into the dull gray morning. Traffic chugged by in a river of steam and exhaust down Middleton's main thoroughfare. The sidewalk was a stream of unhappy pedestrians, their collars turned up against the chilly October air. Cooper had forgotten Lake Michigan's cold kiss in the years he'd been gone. He turned up his collar and headed towards the sun. There weren't many townies on this side of the city, most of them refugees from Illinois, crossing the border into Indiana for cheaper property tax along the town's lakeside. Because of this, the business district was decorated in shades of Chicago, with its coffee shops, tobacco shops, upscale clothing stores, office spaces that weren't boarded up shelters for transients, and pubs that served micro rather than macro brewed beers. While the rest of the city sprawled out like a decaying corpse of stone, steel, and abandoned schools, the business district was an oasis of civilization. Cooper hated it. According to that son-of-a-bitch lawyer, Brett Hollister, Cooper hated everything, including himself. Two blocks from Hollister's office, Cooper found a place called Mulligan's. On the outside, it didn't look as polished as the pubs and restaurants around it. He was relieved to find the dim interior of red brick and brass was only playing host to a dozen or so patrons. No one looked up as he entered. The flat screen hovering over the end of the bar was playing a muted broadcast of the morning news out of Chicago. Cooper found an empty table near the window and turned over his coffee cup. He shed his jacket and squinted against the light as he watched traffic roll by outside. Need a menu? Cooper's eyes took a moment to readjust as he looked towards the waitress pouring coffee into his cup. Her swoop-necked uniform exposed her collarbone and a peak of cleavage. She had the mottled skin of a woman over 40 who spent too much of her 30s in a tanning booth. Her face was a likewise brownish, creased mask of an otherwise pretty face. Her blue eyes popped. Cooper? Brenda? My God, how long have you been back in town? Rolled in on a Greyhound this morning. So, you missed the funeral? Yeah. Did you go? Had to work. The girl who was supposed to cover for me went into labor. So, it's okay. Can I get you anything? Coffee's fine. I'm actually looking for a place to stay for a few days. The bus driver told me all the motels are gone. Said there's a Holiday Inn outside of town, but you're not going to stay at your mother's? Would you? All things considered, you should. I will, eventually. Liar. They laughed, and the bartender called her name. Sorry, gotta go. I'll be back in a few. Don't go anywhere, and don't even think about paying for that coffee. Her hair smelled of shampoo and cigarettes. Cooper breathed it in deeply, running his fingers across her naked, tattooed skin. The imitation leather of her cream-colored couch squeaked with their every movement. Her uniform and his clothes were scattered about the carpeted floor of the living room of the small, white-walled apartment. Her nails scratched his back as she frantically scrambled for a grip, as he struggled for footing and balance. The calico cat, lying on the nearby easy chair, caught in a sunbeam peeking through the vertical blinds of the sliding glass door, eyed them both with a combination of curiosity and feline disdain. Once finished, Cooper sat up and took her pack of cigarettes from the coffee table and lit up with the pink disposable lighter he found hiding in the pack. He offered her the cigarette and lit up another for himself. She laughed, still languishing on the couch. Cooper cocked an eyebrow at this. That bad, eh? God, no. I just never thought my shift would end. Something to be said about old friends. And then some. Cooper motioned with his cigarette toward the now completely bored cat. Yours? My roommate's. Roommate? Don't worry, Coop. He's at work. His name is Monty. Monty? And he's gay, explains the cat. Brenda laughed, surprising herself. You're terrible. So I'm told. An awkward silence passed between them. You planning on visiting your mother? Can we not talk about my mom 2 minutes after having sex? Kinda kills the mood. There was a mood? There's a mood. Since when did you become so romantic? Cooper put out what was left of his cigarette in the already overstuffed ashtray. Since I got into town and made love with my first ever girlfriend. So, that was making love? No. That was the opening act. He took the cigarette from her lips and kissed her. He could feel her breathing the smoke into his mouth. Sucking it down deep, he released it, putting out her cigarette. He leaned in to kiss her again. This is making love. Cooper took a long, hot shower, washing away the trail dust and sweat. At 6'2", he barely felt covered in Brenda's leopard-printed bathrobe as he stepped from the bathroom, followed by a trail of steam about his ankles. Brenda, coming out of the narrow galley kitchen, tried not to laugh, handing him a bottle of beer. As he took a drink, Brenda ran her fingers through the wet shrubbery of his salt-and-peppered hair. When did this happen? My hair? When I turned my father's age. Brenda looked her question, taking the bottle from him and sipping it. I'm 45, Brenda. In my family, I'm lucky to have any hair at all. Well, it needs cutting. You look like a saddle bum. Who says I ain't? Let me cut it for you. He thought a moment, then... You know how I like it. A moment later, and Cooper was watching his hair fall down around his shoulders and lap, sliding lifelessly down the plastic apron surrounding him. So you're going to see your mom? Why? You want to come along? God, no. I suppose I probably should. She's all alone and helpless out there in that big old empty house. Please, Cooper, your mom is anything but helpless. And you're a grown-ass man. And with your dad being gone, did she pay you to try to convince me to visit? Brenda laughed, whisking the top of his head with a small brush. You're going out there. This time, it wasn't a question. Cooper sighed, standing as he removed the apron. He ran his fingers over the now half-inch stubble atop his head, eyeing himself in the mirror hanging over the couch. He looked over at the cat, who hadn't moved from its perch. What do you think? The cat didn't answer. Cooper caught a glimpse of Brenda's reflection in the mirror. You look like him, she said. Now more than ever.
So we already talked about how the idea for this story came up, and we also talked about how, the inspiration actually was a book I read called Dave wait, John Dies in the End was the name of the book by David Wong. And I read somewhere that, you know, if, or maybe you told me this, it's like if you liked a book, like something you recently read, start with that.
Mm-hmm.
Write something in that same, you know, steal somebody's style.
Right.
Like, just totally rip them off. And that was the inspiration. In fact, the title, as you can tell, mm-hmm. is, you know, similar.
Mm-hmm.
And just this whole, there's lots of, there's, it has this whole vibe of, it's quirky. It's a buddy story. Mm-hmm. Like, there's these two dudes are buddies, and the one buddy's kind of a slacker. And it has all of those elements, and it has the what's really going on here element. Like, is there something weird happening here, or is this what it seems? So it has all those elements, which John Dies in the End has,
mm-hmm.
and then some. So I really just kind of copied that style and that genre. And all we have so far is chapter one, and so I'm going to read that, and then on a future show, I'll read chapter two.
Okay.
Chapter one. Gun! Everyone flinched but Dave. Dave was working at the suicide hotline, talking people out of killing themselves. Chuck, his supervisor, yelled out the next call, a would-be gunshot victim. Dave jumped at the chance to answer it. He picked up the phone. This is Dave. I care about you, and so does your family. He was reciting the mandatory part of the script. Where is your family right now? Are they safe? Right on cue, the voice answered. Fuck my family. I'm gonna kill myself. Gun dudes always said that. Sleeping pill chicks always said something like, my family is fine. Who cares? They don't even know me anymore. Or some such bullshit. Hangings. Now those are a challenge. Dave hadn't had a noose call in years. They just don't call suicide hotlines. Once a guy goes to the trouble to buy a rope, learns how to make a noose, actually makes a noose, finds a sturdy beam to toss it over, figures out the chair thing, let's face it, this guy is committed to an idea. He's going to die. Today. It'll take more than a soft-talking, script-reading do-gooder to keep him from swinging. Dave's thoughts drifted back to the phone call. Right, you're going to kill yourself. Yeah, I get that part. I assume you called me because you plan to kill yourself. But see, my job is to get you not to kill yourself. At least not right now. You caught me on kind of a bad day, though. My mind's not quite in it, you know? Ever have one of those days? What? Well, isn't this the suicide helpline? Hotline. Whatever, I don't know what to do. My girlfriend left me yesterday and took my Great Dane with her. This would be easy. How was the sex?
What? With who?
With the dog. Jeez. You dumbass, with you. With her, between you and her. The girl.
Oh, we weren't having sex for like, I don't know, it was okay while it lasted, I guess. Does it matter?
Well, apparently not to you. Dave was just getting started. Maybe that's why she left. I mean, if you can't even remember the last time you porked her, then she probably left out of sheer horny desperation. No wonder she took Rover with her. They're probably in some sleazy hotel by now.
Shut up! You're an asshole.
Doesn't matter to me. I'm not the one with a loaded gun to my head. Dave didn't care that his supervisor was listening in on the call. Chuck had been trying to trip Dave up and expose him as a dangerous cowboy for years, but Dave didn't lose callers. Ever. Yes, his methods were a bit, let's say, unorthodox, but he was a pioneer suicide prevention specialist. Not the feel-good mental health advocacy, let's all hold hands and hug each other kind of a suicide prevention. But the, you're already a loser in life, so put the damn gun down so you're not a loser in death, too, kind of suicide prevention. He was an expert in talking schmucks off the ledge. Kind of a ledge whisperer. Gun Dude said, "Well, I have half a mind to..." Dave cut him off. "Blow away half your mind." That one was too much for Chuck, though. He cut in. His voice was quivering. Son, it's going to be okay. Everything's going to be okay. Just try to breathe and stay calm. We're here to help." Dave was pissed. "Are you shitting me? Get off the phone, Chuck. This one's mine and you're messing it up." Chuck killed Dave's line. Chuck continued. "Your family loves you. We love you. It's going to be okay." Gun Dude was rattled.
No, that other guy was right. I'm a dick. I deserve to die."
Dave stumbled into Chuck's office, nearly tripping on a trash can. "That was my call, you son of a bitch." Someone's at the door. Hold on." The phone went silent, and Chuck panicked.
"Sir? Son, are you there?"
"Dave, damn it, what's his name?" Dave said, "I don't know. It's your call now."
"Shit, Dave, call 911.
"You call 911, man. You took my gun, dude." The caller's voice returned, almost mechanical this time.
"Dave was right. I am a bad person."
Chuck swung back to the phone. No, you're not a bad... I was just..." Dave snatched the phone from Chuck, and he heard the caller say,
"Tell her I did this for her."
"Tell who?" Dave screamed. What about your family? Your dog?"
"It's better this way, Dave."
Dave's eyes went wide. "Don't do this!" Dave's arm went limp, and the receiver dropped and hung by the cord. All eyes were on Dave as the center fell silent. Chuck's face was sheet white. "Get out of my office. You're not taking any more calls today." Dave's voice was quiet and steady. "That was your fault. You killed him. You cannot hang this one on me. You told the guy his ex was fucking his dog. What the hell's the matter with you?" "Chuck, you worthless bastard," Dave yelled. "You know my way works. I had him where I wanted him, and you killed him. Just get the hell out of here. We'll talk about this later." "Fine, fuck off, Chuck," Dave was shouting as he headed for the break room. "Fucking place. You all wish you were as good as me." Dave decided to call Ed. His hand shook as he dialed.
"Yo."
"Ed, I just lost a gun caller."
"Aw, shit. You gonna take the day off and get your shit together? We could watch the game. The Cubs are playing the Ed."
"I said I lost a dude. I don't lose callers."
"Well, maybe you should try being a little nicer."
"I'm serious. Can you come get me? I need a drink."
"I'll be there in 20 minutes.
"Thanks, man. Bring beer. I'll meet you out front." Tina sidled into the break room. In her mid-20s and hipster hot, flaming red hair and a tight body. Always wearing short skirts, tight shirts, and high heels is what Dave wished she would do. Instead, she wore jeans, t-shirts, and Doc Martens, which Dave still thought was pretty sexy. She grabbed a coffee. "Dave, everybody loses a gunshot once in a while."
"Not me," snapped Dave.
Tina shot him a look. "Sorry," said Dave. "I do not lose callers. Not like this." This was weird. "How much have you had to drink in the last 24 hours? "What's that got to do with it? My drinking has nothing to do with this." He sipped his coffee. "We had this guy. He was saying all the right things." "Then Chuck killed him? Come on, Dave."
"Yeah, I know. It seems odd, but I did have him coming down from the ledge. Even after Chuck cut in. And then
he just switched. His voice changed, you know? His tone. I don't know. Maybe I'm just full of shit, but it was just fucked up." "You sound stressed. Maybe you should just take a little time, you know, recoup. Get your shit together."
Tina, I'm telling you, this was noose, they heard Chuck shout. A swinger, Dave said. We never get swingers. I'm taking this one. Dave, wait. Tina followed him out of the break room. Chuck was standing between Dave and his desk. No, Dave, I said no more calls today. Dave said, Chuck, we never get noose calls. You know I should take this one. Chuck was uncharacteristically firm. Tina, take the call. Chuck stared at Dave. Dave stared at Chuck. Tina looked at Dave with concern in her eyes. Dave glanced at Tina, then back to staring at Chuck. Tina looked at Chuck, then at Dave. Dave was still staring at Chuck. Tina shrugged an apology to Dave and pushed past Chuck to go take the call. Dave stood and watched as Chuck spun and stomped back to his office. He stared at Chuck's door after it slammed shut. He did not sit down. This is Tina. I care about you, and so does your family. Where's your family right now? Are they safe? Same old bullshit. Tina's good, but she'll never be able to save a swinger. All right. Thanks for listening to those. Tell us what you think, please.
Yeah.
Go to the Well, we don't have a Facebook page yet. I guess it could be the Don't Panic Facebook page. Don't You Dare Panic on Facebook. And give us your critique. Or you know us personally, probably, unless you stumbled on this podcast. So just send us a message. Or if you want to be on the show, anybody's welcome anytime. And there's a good chance we'll be reaching out to you to say, hey,
right,
why don't you be on our show?
Right.
And we'll hear your critique at that point. In the meantime, again, thank you for listening, especially if you're one of our early listeners. Keep listening. If you liked it, tell somebody about it. You know, say, hey, I stumbled on this great podcast about writing, and they do some reading during the episode, so come on over.
Right.
Any last words?
No, you're pretty good at that.
I am, aren't I?
You're pretty good at the Excellent. Parting shot. No, I think, yeah, just, I mean, eventually we'll have a Facebook page up that people can contact us with, and, you know, yeah, or they can just look us up individually, or, like you said, go to the Don't Panic page.
All right. Well, in the meantime, we are your hosts, Paul Schultz and Steve Benson. This has been Rough Draft.